The Guardian.
This podcast is sponsored by audible.co.uk, the number one online destination for digital audiobooks.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the centre cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world.
I knew that something needed to be done. That was my place in the world, my story. Story of myself, the story of my people.
Okonkwo was well known throughout the nine villages and even beyond. His fame rested on solid personal achievements. As a young man of 18, he had brought honor to his village by throwing a malinze, the cat.
Storytellers are a threat. They threaten all champions of control. They frighten usurpers of the right to freedom of the human spirit, in state, in church or mosque, in party congress, in the university, or wherever.
Africa is a very complex and big place. It's huge. So anything that attempts to cram it into one little box, you know, will fail.
The white man is very clever. He came quietly and peaceably with his religion. We were amused at his foolishness and allowed him to stay. Now he has won our brothers and our clan can no longer act like one. He has put a knife on the things that held us together and we have fallen apart.
Nigeria had a very interesting beginning. We had a lot of expectation how good things would become. Our freedom and independence was very real. Unfortunately, it has not worked out that way.
Who do you hold responsible for what has gone wrong in Nigeria for the past 50 years?
The leadership.
Some of you may recognise the words of the great Nigerian thinker and writer Chinua Achebe, who died at the age of 82. Achebe was in the widest sense a political writer whose essays, lectures and novels interrogated what it meant to live in a post-colonial world. As news of his death broke, one of our guests, Jackie Kay, was at a conference at the University of Liège in Belgium entitled What is Africa to Me Now? She joins us on the phone from her home in Manchester. With us in the studio is the publisher, Ella Olfrey, who will be looking at some of the new directions that political writing is taking today. Jackie, that must have been quite an emotional moment. Tell us what happened in Belgium.
Well, it was really extraordinary. There we were, lots of African writers and academics and people that are interested in post-colonial literature from all around the world. Actually, Nigerians weren't able to come, though. They didn't get visas in time, which everybody was saying was kind of an irony and typical of Nigeria. But we were all absolutely devastated and sad to hear of the news of Chinua Achebe's death. And also it felt like that we wouldn't all be collected there at a conference called What is Africa to Me Now, were it not for Achebe's legacy. And it perhaps recalled for me the importance of such gatherings of people, that there was a great comfort in all of us knowing exactly his significance, his grandeur, his importance, his legacy, the impact that he's had on so many people individually and collectively. And that it was like, it reminded me of a conference that he'd attended at the Makerere University in 1962 in Kampala in Uganda, which changed his life and led to the publication of Things Fall Apart and the launch of the African Writer series, which started, you know, with three or four titles and then went on to publish 350 titles. So it was a strange and almost fitting, if that's not too insensitive a word to use, circle. He would have perhaps liked to think of us all collected in Belgium.
At the beginning of your memoir, Red Dust Road, you quote Sima Chaibi, don't you? Can you read it for us, your particular inscription?
The last of the big rains of the year were falling. It was time for treading red earth with which to build walls. At the beginning of my reading from Red Dust Road in Liège, we had a minute's silence for a Chaibi, which was extraordinarily moving and just such strange, odd timing that we were all collected there.
What book would you suggest people to read who weren't familiar with his work?
His seminal book, Things Fall Apart, is an absolute must, but he also wrote wonderful books for children. He wrote poetry. His collected poems would be a great starting place. And also he's a fantastic essayist, so if you knew nothing about him at all, you might start with his most recent collection of essays, The Education of a British Protected Child, because in that book you get a real sense of his interests, his humour, his wit, and he does go over some of his abiding passions, why he chose to write in English, his upbringing as a child, and you get a sense of how he responded to being paralysed and having an accident. There's this moment in the essays which is very moving, where he describes a friend coming to visit him in hospital after he'd been paralysed in a 1990 car accident, and his friend said, "This wasn't supposed to happen to you." And Achebe writes, "Well, you know, who was it supposed to happen to?" He had no sense of self-pity, just a very pragmatic sense of continuing with life and still managing to give to people.
And I want to bring Ella in here now. Achebe's death has been noted as the beginning of the end of a generation. And we've still got Wally Schenker and we've got Ngugi Wa Thiong'o. But they're both in their late 70s now. Tell us what they mean to a new generation of writing.
It's about a reading experience, that point at which you, anyone who's reading in the English language, has all of the children's books and all of the classics, and then there's an African writer who actually says, well, here you are too, between the pages of a book. And I think that that's the importance. And so for many young writers, it's the way that it informs their early reading years and actually shows a possibility that, you know, you can do this and it's your story to tell too.
Jackie, some of the writing isn't very easy, is it? It's quite metaphorical, for example, and we don't necessarily understand the proverbial place from which his literature comes from.
Well, I think that's literature for you. I mean, the wonderful thing about, say, a poem like Vulture by Achebe's, which is a poem that people have, you know, what is the meaning of the poem Vulture, is all over the internet and these YouTube little videos and clips. That's fantastic. That's what's wonderful about Achebe, that you read his work, and his style, his prose style, is actually very, very clear, sparse, concise. But his work is open to multiple interpretations, and that's what we want from great writers.
In the 53rd Steve Biko lecture, which he gave in Cape Town in 2002, in the presence of Nelson Mandela, he said something that caught my eye, and he was particularly addressing the young writers of South Africa. And he said, "If someone comes from afar and tells you admiringly that you are Africa's answer to Latin American magic realism, or something equally profound, you should smile and slip away as soon as you can. Your admirer has obviously never heard about Africa's oral tradition, nor about that incredible Igbo cultural event called Mbari, in which gods and people and beasts, real or imaginary, assemble on one grand concourse to celebrate the spirit of creativity."
Yeah, that's wonderful. And really true, because within Igbo mythology, there's so many fantastic and wonderful myths, the myth of the twin, the idea that for the Igbo, the middle ground is the best and the strongest place to be. For me, I found that very inspiring, thinking about being mixed race. But there is an actual Igbo saying that is that the middle ground is the strongest place to be. So there's so much that you can take from Igbo myths, culture and mythology, and it's a very, very rich culture and people, and it's mythological. So I love reading about Igbo culture, and I love the way that it's used in Things Fall Apart.
So Ella, the middle ground is the strongest place to be.
Discuss.
There's another wonderful anecdote from Achebe when he's discussing responses to Things Fall Apart, and a young man writes to him from Yonkers, I believe, to say that he'd learned so much about this tribe of people. And Achebe points out that as a young man from Yonkers, he's also from a distinct tribe of people with their own strange customs. And I think that that's the value beyond. We talk a lot about his value and significance to Africans and African writers. But I think that there's a much wider significance in someone who's writing from a purely African perspective. And that's also pointing to the distinct nature of each person's community and the importance of looking at those with eyes wide open and not always thinking of the other as being necessarily far away.
There was another point about that quote that I read that I really liked, which was about the rebelliousness of creativity, that you know, there are all sorts of different sorts of political writers.
When I was thinking about him over this weekend, I was thinking about the sort of the audacity of believing that you can tell a story in a way that hasn't been shown to you before, especially in the form of a novel. And I think that there is a very, very political element to all of his writing. And if you think about Things Fall Apart, for example, that even though he's writing about a past time, in the books that follow, the work is relevant even to African politics and society today. And I think that that's the real strength of political writing, is that it goes way beyond its time, even though it's speaking to you at a specific moment.
At the end of A Man of the People, the book finishes with a coup which led the Nigerian government on to think that Achebe had something to do with the coup, but actually it was just prescience. He was an incredibly prescient writer who actually almost anticipated things before they actually happened. And he was a trailblazer and a pioneer, but he opened the path out for people to come and walk behind him. So that's why I wouldn't call him the father of African fiction anymore. I would call him the grandfather of African fiction, since we're now in our third generation.
In one of his last statements about a year ago, he was asked what was the problem in Nigeria, and he said the fault was all leadership. Do you think he should have become a leader, or was it enough to be a writer?
In 2004 and in 2011, he turned down, you know, offers of major awards by the Nigerian government because he was so disgusted at the level of corruption that went on in his particular Anambra state. And he was involved in politics as a young man for quite a long time, but he then decided that people that were involved in politics in Nigeria were in it for themselves, and that he could make a greater impact as a writer and as an artist. So, no, I think that he was political, he was a politician. The reason that his death is being mourned in the way that it is because he managed to step outside of that. Achebe always wrote from the inside, but him being inside politics, I think, would have been a mistake, because it would have, in an explicit way, because it wouldn't have allowed him to be also serene, if you like, and outside, and possess the kind of dignity that he possessed, because there's so much corruption in Nigerian politics.
I really agree with Jackie, and I think that it's really important to think about the reach and the longevity that someone's writing has. As Jackie mentioned, his children's books and his poetry, as well as the novels and the criticism, meant that he was speaking to a much wider audience. And I'm not really sure we would have all felt the impact of his death in the same way if he had been a prime minister for a period of time. I think that a writer has a way of reaching and changing the way that people feel and think in a way that a politician can never even hope for.
No, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, W.H. Auden once famously said, poetry makes nothing happen. But for Chinua Achebe, he made things happen all the time with his poetry and with his fiction, and things are still happening.
Jackie Kay on Chinua Achebe there. This week's two interviewees are political in very different ways. Pakistani writer Mohsin Hamid's new novel is called How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. It offers a cynical and colourful reflection on how economic success is driving every aspect of life in Asia, social, economic, political and cultural. Our second writer, Jim Crace, has chosen to couch his equally outspoken politics in a historical fable. Let's hear first from Mohsin.
We'll be right back. Look, unless you're writing one, a self-help book is an oxymoron. You read a self-help book so someone who isn't yourself can help you. That someone being the author. This is true of the whole self-help genre. It's true of how-to books, for example. And it's true of personal improvement books, too. Some might even say it's true of religion books. But some others might say that those who say that should be pinned to the ground and bled dry with a slow slice of a blade across their throats. So it's wisest simply to note a divergence of views on that subcategory and move swiftly on. None of the foregoing means self-help books are useless. On the contrary, they can be useful indeed. But it does mean that the idea of self in the land of self-help is a slippery one. And slippery can be good. Slippery can be pleasurable. Slippery can provide access to what would chafe if entered dry. This book is a self-help book. Its objective, as it says on the cover, is to show you how to get filthy rich in rising Asia. And to do that, it has to find you, huddled, shivering, on the packed earth under your mother's cot one cold, dewy morning. Your anguish is the anguish of a boy whose chocolate has been thrown away, whose remote controls are out of batteries, whose scooter is busted, whose new sneakers have been stolen. This is all the more remarkable since you've never in your life seen any of these things. The whites of your eyes are yellow, a consequence of spiking bilirubin levels in your blood. The virus afflicting you is called hepatitis E. Its typical mode of transmission is fecal-oral. Yum. It kills only about 1 in 50, so you're likely to recover. But right now, you feel like you're going to die. Your mother has encountered this condition many times, or conditions like it anyway. So maybe she doesn't think you're going to die. Then again, maybe she does. Maybe she fears it. Everyone is going to die. And when a mother like yours sees in a third-born child like you the pain that makes you whimper under her cot the way you do, maybe she feels your death push forward a few decades, take off its dark, dusty headscarf, and settle with open-haired familiarity and a lascivious smile into this, the single mud-walled room she shares with all of her surviving offspring.
Did it start with the concept of a self-help book or with that voice?
Neither. Douglas Adams says that the secret to flying in The Hitchhiker's Guide is throwing yourself at the ground and missing. And so when I write a novel, I'm of the, you know, Adams tradition, and I throw myself at the ground and hit multiple times. In this case, I'd spent 2 or 3 years working on a draft. The last draft I was working on tried to paint a portrait of Pakistan that was like an impressionist painting with small stories, each told in very different voices, which in aggregate would resolve themselves into a picture of a country. It failed disastrously. I salvaged a couple of short stories from it, but it basically didn't work at all. And I was in New York, and John Freeman, who's a friend of mine and is now the editor of Granta, and I were talking about some literary fiction we were reading and how, you know, we started saying it's a bit like self-help, and we both laughed, and I said, my next novel will be a self-help book. You know, guffaws ensued. Went back to Pakistan and couldn't shake the idea, because the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, perhaps there is an element of self-help for me in writing a novel, and possibly even in reading a novel, and that then led to this structure.
Tash Orr says that 8 out of 10 bestsellers in Asian bookshops are self-help books. Are they all the rage in Pakistan?
People are looking for guidance. The world is changing very rapidly, and so people want to know how to do stuff, how to do a job interview, how to build a spreadsheet, how to speak English. People are looking for instruction.
Do you imagine somebody picking up your novel as if it was a self-help book and not realizing to start with?
I'm still waiting for the baffled reviewer who will say, it's interesting, but I'm not sure this whole narrative thing really works in helping us understand how to get rich.
And where did the you come from? Because you address the reader in that second person, that immediate second person.
Well, the you came in part because I think the self-help book often does take a U form. It also came because I've used variations of the you in all of my novels because I'm interested in the relationship between the reader and the writer. And also because, in a sense, this novel became an examination of the shadow that's cast by the growth narrative, the dominant sort of uber-capitalist growth narrative, which is the market, which is all about more money, more cars, a bigger house. And then I thought, you know, the Sufi epic poem, which is really the most popular form of literature in Pakistan, because in a pre-literate society, poetry that's sung is the most popular form of literature. So Sufi love poem generally or often takes the form of a second-person address to a beloved in a nameless set of characters and events. That's a love story.
As you sweep from the grinding rural poverty of your opening to the inner circle of a corrupt minister, the detail feels just right. Did you worry about getting, say, the proportions right between the price of a DVD delivery, the salary of the delivery boy, and the cost of his daily carton of milk?
I did the math, but I also just, I listen and I look. So I didn't do any research, really, for the book. I did a little bit of Googling and Wikipediaing for minor things like what color is the effluent of a textile mill, for example. Is it gray or yellow? The bigger challenge was, I believe people read differently now. And you know, this is, for me, a sprawling 19th century epic novel. But it's 200 pages long. And I think it's 200 pages long in part because there are numerous, I guess you could say, reading strategies and compression techniques that are available when you're addressing a 21st century reader that weren't available when you're addressing a mid-19th century reader. So, for example, we are much more apt, I think, if you take little samples of a life or of a story, to connect those into an arc.
We're very happy with a kind of cinematic jump now.
Absolutely. And so for me, I was intrigued by the idea of trying to write a profoundly uncinematic book, a very novelish novel, bookish book, that availed itself of the opportunities for compression that come from stuff that cinema has taught to people about how stories can work.
It's written with what feels like a barely suppressed rage at working conditions, at the inadequacy of the forces of law and order, the kind of power wielded by the military and so on. Is this a political book?
What else is there? You know, I tend to think that when we say something is apolitical, what we're saying is that its politics is to pretend to not have politics. So I think all books are political. You know, when you write about the mansion in Victorian England, and you don't talk about the Jamaican sugarcane plantation that funded the mansion, that's a political choice. So in this novel, yes, it is, I guess you could say, overtly political and very conscious of its politics.
Was there a project? Was there a message? Or there's an audience you're trying to reach, people you're trying to convert?
Not so much. I write op-eds and I write nonfiction where I try to put down what my politics is in that form. For me, fiction does something slightly differently. You know, fiction is there to catalyze a reader's reaction to something. So in The Reluctant Fundamentalist, I wasn't trying to put forward, for example, here is a critique of American capitalism and imperialism through Chinggis's voice. That was present there, but I didn't wholly agree with what Chinggis had to say, obviously. The more important thing in that book was to tell a narrative which is a conversation of which you only hear one side. So a constantly destabilized conversation. You're trying to compensate for the half that you're not hearing. That ends ambiguously. That doesn't end. So it's like you're standing on your leg, you know, for 4 hours, one leg as you're reading the book, trying to balance yourself. And then you realize that nobody's waiting for you and is going to tell you to stand down. And the moves you made in the process of stabilizing yourself and the way that you put your second leg back down reflects yourself at yourself. And in this novel, it's something similar. It's not that I'm trying to say anything clear-cut about capitalism is bad. Yeah, of course. I mean, those are banalities. What I'm trying to elicit is, you know, what is the emotional response that we have when looking at this stuff, and what does it make us want to look for?
You said that you were looking for something a little bit more complicated than straightforward realism, your jump cuts, your kind of threading these moments along the story of a life. Does a novel, a political novel, as you're saying, does it need more than straightforward realism these days?
I don't believe in realism, I guess. We now have long-form television dramas that have taken away one advantage the novel had, which is the length of engagement that it affords in a single opportunity. So when you read an 800-page book, you know, you have a 16, 20, 30-hour engagement with a single work of art. And that was the longest engagement people tended to have with a work of art. But now when you have 10 series or 7 series of 16 one-hour episodes each, there are longer engagements possible. And as you have character-driven, realist, multi-character narratives, you know, The Sopranos and Wire and whatnot, that is being done in a different place. For me, there are books that require 800 pages even today. But if a book doesn't require the extra time, as opposed to in a, let's say, a summer reading in your Russian villa, where the more time you spend is better, now the preference would be the opposite.
So if The Reluctant Fundamentalist is as much a story of a college student reacting to the world of work, what's the new book? What's How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia? What's that about?
In terms of the story of the novel, it is, for me, really a lifelong love story. Actually, multiple love stories, but one in particular, the love between a boy and the woman he calls the pretty girl and continues to call the pretty girl, even when she's an old woman and they're both at death's door, enacted against the brutality of, you know, contemporary uber-capitalist existence.
And how's the book being read in Pakistan?
You know, it's being read. The wonderful thing is that there are no people. You know, there's just individual readers, and they react in different ways in Pakistan as they do in Britain, you know. The one thing which I'm struck by from readers, not just in Pakistan, but in lots of places, is how many people tell me that they have cried at the end of the book. What I guess I would most like to achieve, much more than a sense of, oh, we're angry at this, at the conditions around us, because people are anyway, is instead the notion that, you know, it's possible to achieve a certain degree of human connection and achieve feelings together. I don't stand against the market. I think that it's not clear to me what other systems we have. But I stand against, you know, the monopoly of the market. I think we need to have antidotes, and we need to have tinkering, and we need to have things that undermine the market and that resist.
Mohsin Hamid there talking to Richard Lee about How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, which is published by Hamish Hamilton. Ella, it's a novel that's written in a European social realist tradition. Would you say that's right?
I think so. And then he does something completely different. If you think about the huge success of self-help manuals, especially in developing countries, Mohsin takes this idea and runs with it. And you have a sort of a distance at the beginning of each chapter from the protagonist, and then you're drawn into this amazing and rather beautifully told life. And I think that structurally this is an ambitious book and, to my mind, his best.
A move forward from his previous. He's always been a very good observer, hasn't he, of happening India, particularly Pakistan, particularly.
Yes, he has, and there's a depth of emotion here that I think will draw all readers in, but he's making some really powerful comments about water, about the economies of Asian countries, and about the cost to the people. And you really get to care about his characters and therefore about the wider issues as well.
Our next interviewee, Jim Crace, has written a fable set at some time in the past when feudal rulers are moving in on the common lands and immigrants are greatly to be feared. Sounds familiar. Ella, this is a very different sort of political writing, isn't it?
It's a very different kind of political writing. And at the very beginning, I read this book in one breathless afternoon, frantically trying to figure out exactly what point in time Jim was writing about. It's bawdy. It is almost, at some point, I expected some kind of witch burning to happen. Very, very atmospheric. And Jim Crace doing something sort of really wonderful. And the heart of it is this idea of land and people and belonging, which he doesn't let go of throughout the whole thing.
It reminded me of Arthur Miller's The Crucible. And I was particularly interested that it seemed to hark back to the mid-20th century when actually politics was so dangerous that people wrote allegorically.
Yes, you really have that sense that he has a big idea and a big project that he's telling you through the stories of these people who are living very, very close to the land. So as you're concerned with their livestock, with the domestic politics of living on this farm, you're also really aware that Jim Crace is telling you about your responsibilities as a citizen. I think it's not stretching it too far to actually say that he is concerned with those things and wanting us all to think about them.
Let's hear now from Jim Crace talking about his novel Harvest.
I'm going to read a short section from the beginning of Harvest, and it's the point where an outsider has come to the village, put up shelter for the night, believing that that will give her and her family the right to stay on the common land when she is attacked in the hut that she has been hiding in. This was the moment that the woman showed her face. No witnesses are in any hurry to blot out the vision of her rising from the den. What were they to make of her? She was not beautiful, not on first encounter anyhow. She had what we might call, behind her back, a weasel face, wide-cheeked, thin-lipped, a short receding chin, a button nose, and eyes and hair as shiny, dark and dangerous as belladonna berries. What caught our women's eyes at once was the velvet shawl she wore round her shoulders, an expensive lordly weave in heavy Turkish mauve and silver thread. Their instinct was to call out, "Mind your cloth!" Her blood was bulbing on her little chin and might soon drop to spoil the velvet. Their second thought declared, "She's dressed beyond her station. A woman of her kind could not possess a shawl such as that without first stealing it. Even Lucy Kent, the master's wife, had never owned a shawl such as that. Indeed, a shawl such as that, so far as anybody could remember, had never crossed the village boundaries before. It's not surprising, then, that so many of our wives and daughters widened their eyes in envy, hoped to feel the weight of it between their fingers, and wondered what their chances were of wearing it themselves. The village men, of course, were not so taken by the cloth. They noticed it, of course, and how it added a becoming colour to the scene. They could imagine making use of it, laid out in the hidden corner of some field, far from their wives. But as men will, they were assessing her by standards other than her clothes. They surveyed her, hoof, horn, and tail. And then they surveyed her two men. What they saw was someone who might happily infect their dreams, a wide-hipped woman who was enthralling to behold in ways they never could explain, and all the more so for not being beautiful or statuesque, but rather someone within reach, and someone who was defiantly and irresistibly proud.
In that extract, we have the arrival of the strangers in this very small enclosed community. To what extent do you think of it as a Stranger Calls novel?
I remember that I felt that I was writing a novel that was an island novel rather than a Stranger Calls novel. I think it is an island novel in which people are washed ashore. And it's an island in the middle of a forest. But I kind of feel that. Sometimes people say, is this medieval or is it Tudor or whatever? But I feel, in my pretentious way, that it's actually a Shakespearean novel. In other words, the landscape is the landscape of Shakespeare. For me, it's not quite about strangers. It's about migration. It's about, even though this is a novel set in the past, it's really about 21st century issues. And I live in, as you know, a very multicultural city, Birmingham. And what I'm aware of is that even though I'm not complacent about how successful Birmingham is, it's generally pretty successful as a mixed community, except when there are pressures in society, when we're on a cusp of change in the way that we are in Harvest. So when Birmingham was going through the recession and we were losing all the jobs in the motor industry, that was the time that the far right in Birmingham came into play again. And that was the time when neighbours were resenting neighbours because they were born and bred Brummies, and those Brummies with darker skins had only been there for two generations. This is, in a way, the hidden subtext, which I hope I don't make too thumpingly clear in the novel, that this is about the natural impulse that all human beings have to be loyal to the place where they were born, but nevertheless aware that sometimes they will be forced to move on. And the irony, perhaps, of this book is that even though there's resentment about outsiders coming in, for perhaps good reasons, the resentment that is against the outsiders coming in will soon be directed against the people that are forced to leave. So we are never, any of us, free from this strange two-way tug that we have to stay and to leave, to be loyal to where we are, to be excited about where we're going. So that's really my take on the Stranger thing.
But there is another stranger as well, who is the new landlord who has just inherited the manor. And he's going to change everything. He's going to bring sheep in, isn't he? Which is, in a way, an 18th century story. I was quite interested in the time that you set it in.
Well, actually, the enclosures date from... I found this out since I've written the novel, not before, because I don't do any research. But they can date from the end of the 14th century all the way through to the late 18th century. The stranger that comes in that wants to make change is that actually just represents to me capitalism. I know that there are many things that can force people away from their houses, but very often emigration and migration is occasioned by change, by people being greedy in your area and making you move on. And one of the impulses of this book set that far back about enclosures was actually reading an article, and it may well have indeed have been in The Guardian, about how farmers in South America were being forced off their land right now by the greed of soya conglomerates. And that story can be told anywhere else in the world all the way through history. And I've written, in a way, this exact novel before. My novel, Arcadia, was about an old marketplace and people loving being in the rough and tumble of a city, and all that is destroyed because someone wants to build a mall.
The central character, the narrator, is Walter Thirsk, who's married into this community. So he is an incomer of a previous generation, but then has been widowed. So he's quite a solitary character. Yes. Now he's in a strange position because he's halfway between the manor house and the village. And he often reports things or he hears about things, but he doesn't always witness them. He's got to be an outsider to a certain extent. He's got to be more articulate. He's got to be able to write, whereas they can't.
There are all sorts of things at play there. Normally I would write the godlike narrator. If he's really on high, or she's really on high, let's not be sexist about gods that I don't believe in. Anything that goes on, that narrator can comment on and can witness and can be detailed about. But I realised that as soon as I had the first-person narrator, then I only had one pair of eyes. And I began to become excited by that. I began to feel that this would be quite a good joke for him to only see things from a distance, that, you know, from the turret, or to hear them reported next day. And there was another thing at play as well that came in that I thought, well, I've been very aware, given my background and given the kind of things people have said about people like me, is that because I come from a working class background and my father was working class, sort of, he was a groundsman, that somehow the presumption is that his vocabulary has to be small, as if only education gives you vocabulary. Actually, vocabulary comes to you if you're bright and if you're inquisitive. And my dad, who left school when he was 11 because he had osteomyelitis, so was a sick man, had a fantastic vocabulary. You know, in England, even the ways that we describe the English language seem to be have class imbued into them. We talk about the Queen's English, we talk about Oxford English, we talk about BBC English, all of which have got a class imprint. And I've always hated that.
Nevertheless, the vocabulary you give him is very carefully tailored to a son of the soil, isn't it? For example, he says, I am furrowed sad tonight. I love that. Yes. I am furrowed sad tonight. Yeah. That's a word that comes out of his life on the land.
Yes. I can go out on my bike or on my car, you know, 20 minutes from Birmingham, and I can stand in a field in which there is still ridge and furrow. And there are loads of them. I'm coming on the train today through Watford Gap, that terrible service station, you look out the window and you can see wonderful fields in which the ridge and furrow is still there and sturdy and deep. And when I stand in the middle of these fields, I know that those ridge and furrows are hundreds of years old.
There's a sense in which this isn't a historical novel at all, is it? It's a fable in an imagined landscape. It's like Erewhon or something like that.
That's right. All I've done is to take issues which concern us today and rather than locating you in a real world, I want to dislocate you in a world that you're not familiar with, a world entirely of my invention. And the advantage for that for me is, and the thing, and it annoys some critics immensely, but sod it, I don't care, is that it gives me complete free rein to make up absolutely anything I want to. So if I want to invent a mushroom that doesn't exist, such as in this one, fairy caps, they don't exist, I'll invent one because I need it for the plot.
Now, this has come up in previous novels. I'm thinking particularly of Being Dead, which was my entry point to your work,
right,
where everybody thought you'd minutely study the decomposition process of corpses,
yes,
because you had all the larva working away. But actually you hadn't, had you? Did you say that you didn't research it?
I didn't research it at all. I
invented all these maggots and creatures who we now hear about in all those thrillers involving autopsies.
Well, I invented the human side of it, But what we need to remember is that we think that that is a novel only about human beings dying, and we are uncomfortable with dead bodies. The novel being dead, really its purpose was to remind us that human beings, the comfort of that novel actually, is to remind us that human beings are like other animals, and that when we die, the same things could happen to us as happen to dead animals. In other words, creatures come along. So even though I made it up, I made it up out of a substrate knowledge of natural history, because natural history is my subject.
Now, coming back to this novel and the politics of it, you have some really ringing, almost slogans in it, don't you? Like, dissent is never counted, it is weighed, the master always weighs the most.
Yes.
Do you think of yourself as a polemical novelist?
Well, I think of myself as being a horribly polemical person. And you'd be horrified if I'd had a drink in me and we were in a pub and we got onto grammar schools or something, you know, or the National Health Service. But fiction does something different. I wish I could write fiction. And in fact, it was my first intention to write fiction that was a slogan and that was a placard, so that I could stand shoulder to shoulder with writers such as Steinbeck or Robert Tressel or Twain or Orwell, the kind of people that would address political issues unembarrassedly. But I find that when I'm writing fiction, that my voice doesn't sing like that. It doesn't work like that. And I also feel that you don't want to be lectured in fiction. What you want is to be left with something in the air that has been not entirely mediated and answered by the writer, but is requiring you to mediate and to make the mix. And so I'm much more bourgeois in my fiction than I am in my politics, I think.
Jim Crace there, and Harvest is published by Picador. Ella, I said before that interview that Harvest reminded me of the allegorical writing of the mid-20th century. Do you think it's out of time, or does it belong to a community of political writing of these days?
If it is out of time, we're desperately in need of it. Because when I read the book, I did feel very much that it didn't feel old-fashioned. I think there's something about the way that Jim approaches it that makes it feel very contemporary and certainly very relevant. And it's, to my mind, probably the best way that one can talk about politics is to give us a story that completely engages and captivates us, but also ensures that we're thinking all the way through and you don't stop thinking about it when you put it down.
Is it a good read as well as being politically provocative?
I think it is. There's a wonderful scene at the very beginning where he describes a scene when the harvesters come in and there's a big party and people are getting away with all kinds of mischief. And he writes that very, very well. As I said earlier, that it's quite a bawdy book at times. But at the same time, there's a sense throughout that something is about to happen and you have no idea what it is. And so there's this thrill and this menace and this dark looming event up ahead, and for that reason alone, it's a completely compelling read.
And that's all from us this week. Thanks to Ella Allfrey, Jackie Kay, Mohsin Hamid, Jim Crace and Richard Lee. I hope you find plenty there to bring you into the discussion yourselves. Whether you come from SoundCloud, iTunes or Mixcloud, you can join in at guardian.co.uk/books. Just click on the podcast button at the top of the page. I'm Claire Armistead, from me and my producer, Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
Visit audible.co.uk/guardianaudio to choose from a selection of over 60,000 titles. With Audible, you can make more time for books by downloading and listening wherever you are and whatever you're doing.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.